at the behest of the Board of Officers of Malinois. We've arranged a program for the Summer Room starting tonight, which will have seven Mondays, consecutive Monday nights of lectures, Urim, all dealing with the Gospel. Tonight's guest speaker is Rabbi Sotadov Krakowski, who's affiliation to Kassus is Rabbi Moshe of the OU in Eretz Yisrael, who's kind enough to give us an evening to come out and explain the Yidim's idea to do with Restaurant. My first wife, I guess, asked the Rabbi to say a few words, and then Rabbi Krakowski will take over, and I'm sitting down, and I'm talking tonight.
I feel an achrayus to speak out, and I hope no one takes this the wrong way. I mean, in all sincerity, I think the Rabbi is the only speaker we have that's affiliated with a specific kashrus organization, I believe, right? Of all the speakers? The only one that's a specific kashrus organization.
Yeah, well, kashrus we organization.
So, this is not nothing to do with the OU. It's not an endorsement of the OU Hechsher. It's not a kashrus. And my saying that is not chalila. If anything, the world, especially we're Anglos here, we have to realize the Hakoras HaTov we all have to have to the OU, the organization, the OU, the Kashrus, what they did, what do you call them? They wrote the book of Kashrus, and we have to have Hakoras HaTov. I just don't want the lecture tonight to be an implication of anything, like every other Heksher, whether it's Eidah Haredis, or the OU, or Rabbi Rubin, or any Heksher in the world. You ask your Rav, whoever you ask Shilas to, if they feel it's a Heksher, you should be Soymachan. I you'll do what you want, Rav Osai. You know, I'm not a dictator. But my idea wasn't that tonight would be to pepper the Rav with questions about the OU and what does the OU do about this and what about Papalino restaurant or whatever, Pagherino, and this and that Shechita and that. It wasn't my intention, you know, if you want to badger him and put him on the spot, go like a vote. But we're here to learn, maybe wait till afterwards. We're here to learn and be educated about kashrus. It's, you know, nowadays the consumer koach is in, and certainly in Torah, it's Talmud Torah, to learn and to understand, not just to be blind and not to understand. And you'll get an appreciation for the OU and for all the organizations because, you know, we don't realize from our kitchens where we buy ready-made products with a Hechsher to a restaurant where there's all sorts of things going on, and we're going to see tonight how complex it is and how not simple it is, and you'll have more of an appreciation and Hakaras HaTov to the organizations that allow you to really walk into a place and eat. All right.
Yashar Kach, thank you both to the Rav, to the Moed Asa, to Yichil Spiro. Actually, tremendous, mamish, a tremendous kavod to be able to speak to such a crowd tonight. Not just because of the topic, and not just because of the fact that people are concerned about the topic, but to be able to speak to a community which is essentially a community that are all people that the one thing that there might be many things that bring this community together, but one thing that certainly is a unifying force amongst the community is the chashivos for Eretz Yisrael, for coming to live in Eretz Yisrael and to take all sorts of hardships tonight in order to be able to come to Eretz Yisrael. It's a tremendous chazal and the Torah itself lays so much importance to that, that it's just that I feel it's mamish a tremendous zechus. The truth is, unfortunately, I think many people when they came to Eretz Yisrael, all the various difficulties that they might have anticipated, probably one of the things that wasn't so much anticipated was the complex world of kashrus in Eretz Yisrael. And how much so in America everybody has, you know, certain much more relaxed approach, and a lot of it justfully so. So very often I explain to people that in America, anybody who's the whole kashrus is not a forced upon kashrus, and it's both mitzad the people who are working for kashrus, and both mitzad the people who have kashrus on their facility, on their company, plant, factory, restaurant, food service, whatever it may be. The point is, it's not forced upon, it's voluntary, so it is much more straightforward. And I hear that to Israel because to some extent it's always forced upon, and there's a lot of competition, and there's all sorts of different opinions, it becomes much more complex. But nonetheless, that's one of the complexities that we are faced when we come to Eretz Yisrael, no matter how many years we're living in Eretz Yisrael, and things constantly change. I was talking once to somebody, Choshev Talmud Chacham, and he told me, you know, the truth is, the reason why I only eat Eidah Charedis isn't because I don't think there's anything else good out there. He says, but when, you know, he says, when this kashrus organization changes their infrastructure slightly, or that kashrus organization changes its infrastructure slightly, I'm not going to be from the first person to know about it. It'll take me a month, 2 months, 3 months, and I might have been eating something that I didn't want to eat in that interim. So I stick with that which I'm sure about. So, you know, it's not something that we necessarily anticipated, but that's the way it is here, that things are definitely much more complex. Very often people say that's the same reason why they don't eat in restaurants. Say, I don't want to go out to eat because in my home, I know what's going on, I'm on top of it, it's my own situation, there's no shiles that come up really, it's very simple, it's very straightforward. But I go out to eat in a restaurant, and all of a sudden it's very complex, I'm trusting other people, there's all sorts of pressures. Truth is, I tell people, there's also the flip side of the coin they don't see. Say, in your kitchen, you cook only fleishiks? In your kitchen, you cook only milchiks? How big is your kitchen? Right? Most people, most of us, all of us, I think, we have milchiks and fleishiks in the same kitchen. Very often, especially here in Eretz Yisrael, it's not such a big kitchen. You have the same refrigerator. Sometimes you may have the same sink, so they might be in very close proximity. You might use the same stovetop. You might have similar pots for each. There's a lot of complications that happen in a person's house, and you don't have a mashkiach overseeing everything that's done in your own house. It's your own decisions. It's your own things. And if you have a shayla, you have to call up. And it's your decision when the Rav tells you it's the chaskhilo, it's the diavet. It's your own decision. Very often in a restaurant, there's no such thing as the chaskhilo and the diavet, actually. A kashrus organization, hopefully, if it's a trustworthy kashrus organization, it sets its standards. And because they're guaranteeing you X, Y, and Z as a standard, they must meet that standard. They can't say, oh, you know, tonight was the diavet night. Tonight was the night we didn't quite meet that standard. No, you're paying for a certain standard. There's no b'diavad, and so, you know, so I tell it to restaurants all the time. I say, you have to, you know, you're right. They tell me, but my rabbi said that the same thing happened to me in the kitchen. Erlich guy, a Frum guy who owns the place, who runs the place, and he tells you the same thing happened to me in the kitchen, in my own kitchen last Friday. And the rabbi said it was fine. And my rabbi's a big Talmud Chacham, and I'm saying, Taka is a big Talmud Chacham, and he's Taka right. But that's not what people are coming to restaurants to eat. They're not coming to eat the Shasat Chak, the Erev Shabbos, the Shasat Chak, the Diyavik. They're coming to eat whatever the standards are that they're guaranteed. So the kashrus organization that's taking responsibility for a particular standard, assuming that they're trustworthy and they are honest, they're going to keep to that standard, and you're guaranteed that. So there's no bid, there shouldn't be a bid Diyavik in the restaurant. And there should always be that proper supervision. It might be assessed by different kashrus organizations and with different types of genders, whether it's milchiks or fleishiks, or whether it's a facility like a hotel or a catering hall that might have a milchik and a fleishik kitchen, maybe even somewhat of close proximity. However much some places are going to opt for a shkachas midah, some kashrus agencies might opt for less hours, or they might call a shkachas midah, but it doesn't mean that they open and they lock, and it doesn't mean that they have that the freezers are locked, so only by the Mashkiach, and only the Mashkiach has the keys. It might mean all sorts of different exact things. In Eretz Yisrael, what we call Hashgachat Tumidah in America is really called Hashgachat Tumudah, just for the books. You know, if someone tells you Hashgachat Tumidah means that there's a regular Hashgachat. It means that there's a Mashkiach who works there pretty much for a full-time job. He's there 8 hours, he's there most of the busy hours during the day. It doesn't necessarily mean that he's there that there's a Mashkiach present from the second anybody sets foot into the restaurant until the second the last person steps out of the restaurant. It means that he's there for a good part of the day. You need to hear the word Hashgachat Muda if you're looking for what we call Hashgachat Tumidah, which means that it follows it the whole entire time, and it's there from beginning to end. But now we spoke about maybe possibly some of the Yisro Nut, some of the benefits of eating in restaurants. We'll talk about what are the complications that face various kashrus organizations in certifying a restaurant. Now, of course, you're going to have different types of restaurants. You have big restaurants, small restaurants. You have restaurants that the ownership is dati, they're from the Shomer Torah mitzvahs, that they have maybe a number of workers who are Shomer Torah mitzvahs, or places that are vastly Arabs or other sorts of goyim that are working in the restaurant. Maybe that there's people who aren't from, people who are from. There's all sorts of different exact setups. And of course, you're going to feel more comfortable in a place where there's a lot of from people working there, and you know there's a lot of people who care about the kashrut, as opposed to a place where it's either all goyim or it's all irreligious Jews that care definitely far less about the kashrut. When you come into a restaurant, you know, going basically if you're taking over a restaurant that doesn't have at least any kashrut to talk about. And we'll take it from there, we'll talk about all the things that you're going to see. You come into a kitchen and you see, you take a fleishig restaurant, we'll start with, louder? We'll take a fleishig restaurant to start with, that you have, you come in and you see, there's meat. You ask them, can I see the refrigerators? And you go into the refrigerator, you open it up. Everything in the refrigerator is open, it's hanging from hooks, it's sitting in basins of sauces, being cured in all sorts of different ways, being aged. Open meat, over here, over there, whether it's chicken, whether it's beef, there's open meat all over the place. And you ask them, was there a Mashkiach present? So, of course, didn't have any cash to talk about. There's no Mashkiach present. So right away, you start having an issue there without getting into all the process of what makes something indeed basar, shenis alam in ayin, meat that hasn't been, that's been out of the supervision of someone religious. We won't get into all the process of what might make it or what will not make it basar, shenis alam in ayin. But over here, simply speaking, you have an issue of basar, shenis alam in ayin, such meat that hasn't been under supervision. That hasn't been under supervision, and you're going to have to make some sort of system to make sure that this meat is okay. Now, why isn't that a problem in a supermarket? When you go into the supermarket and you buy meat, maybe it wasn't under supervision, right? So that's very simple. When you buy meat in the supermarket, it comes in a sealed package. If the package isn't sealed, if you look in any kashrus guidebook from any kashrus organization, they'll tell you, if our packages of meat are not sealed in the supermarket, don't buy it. Or we can't take responsibility for it. Buy it on your own responsibility. But the point is once it's open, so in a chanami. If it's not properly sealed with what we call chaysim say chaysim, which means that there's on the seal itself there's some sort of other seal in some way that can't really be removed. Unless that if you open it will be invalid in some way, so that enough that you're able to switch what's inside of it without if you can still switch what's inside of it with the rip that there is or the opening that there is in the package, so it's going to be a problem. So over here in such a place, in such a restaurant, we have in the refrigerator or freezer or some sort of curing closet such meat, that's one problem. So you move on. You move on to the preparation area. So of course, without mentioning you're going to have in any restaurant, milchik, fleishik, parver, vegetarian, doesn't make a difference, there's going to be problems with trumas and maisers. You need to watch where it's coming from. Now, the truth is, trumas and maisers are actually a little bit of a lesser concern than many of the other things. Because most of the peiros and yerokos that are coming in, peiros actually are a little bit of a different issue because you have netzer, revoy, and arla shilas. But most of the peiros, most of the yerokos, most of the vegetables that are coming in to any given food service, by the time it gets there, it was maisered a few times. So it's not something you should be not concerned with, you still should be extremely concerned about it. And in a good place, they probably, even if they're getting it from one of the most Mahajan Ashkacha organizations, they'll very likely re-meister it in the actual food service so that they can guarantee you the standards that Trumas and Meisters were for sure taking it off, and that the Kashrus organization that's giving the Ashkacha on the place feels they can guarantee it personally, not there being somich on somebody in some farm or somebody somewhere else or in some sort of machzan where Trumas and Meisters might have been taken, or where Trumas and Meisters might have been taken multiple times. But that there's somebody that they feel that they can take full achrayis for. But that's a side point. But you come through, and see, that's of course something you're going to have to take care of. You're going to ask them where they're ordering their fruits and vegetables from. You're going to have to mark it down. It's going to have to be something that you know it has to come from a source that's doing it properly to the same extent that the kashrus organization is giving the hashgacha on the food service would be comfortable with. But then you move on to the cooking area, what they call in Hebrew the pasacham, the hot strip, where all the hot food preparations are coming along, where they're boiling things, frying things, baking things, grilling things, and you come into that area, and you see there Ahmad and Muhammad and Petro. You see there, you know, a nice selection of Goyim Leminehem. And they're putting in the stuff in the oven. Not only that, you might have a convection oven. And every time they close the door, they're turning on the oven anew. There's a new fire going on. That's how most convection ovens work in the industrial world. There's what they call in Hebrew a combo, because it has combustion steam, it has, you know, works on different systems. But you come in there, and so they, you see them closing the doors, and we call them bishlakum. Now, one of the things I've been very often told in certain food services, when I come in and you see it, there's a problem of bishlakum, they say, yeah, but that's for the workers' food. For the food for the workers. And the reply to that is, are the two kitchens here? Because bishul akum, something that unfortunately many people in kashrus, I found at least unfortunately, don't know the halacha. Bishul akum, it's a chaticha shel isura, it's food that's forbidden, and because of that, it's treif midrabbanan, so we might be a little bit more mako with how we're kashering it, but with how we kasher afterwards. But it needs to be kashered. If they cook bishul akum in a pan, that pan you can't put in it afterwards, or on a rack. You can't just put on it something else afterwards and say, well, that's kosher, because that a yid turned on the fire, or a yid closed the door to the oven. That was bishul akum. So you have to have a system to make sure that it's not going to be goyim cooking. Now there's two deyos in terms of what makes something bishul akum. There's a das beis yosef, there's a das ramah. Whether the ramah holds that merely the fire has to have been lit by a yid, and we'll get to what needs to be a shayim material mitzvah momentarily, but whether the fire had to be lit by a yid, which is a shittas ramah, or whether the food, at least partially, had to have been cooked by a yid, must be the das beis yosef. So if you want to, if you're Svadi, or if you want to be makbid on the Beis Yosef for whatever reason, or if a kashrus organization is claiming to be makbid on the Beis Yosef, then you need to make sure that not only was the oven closed by a yid, but there was some sort of pool or some sort of that in some capacity the Jew had an involvement in actually the actual cooking of the food. Has to take it out of the oven, maybe, has to put it in the oven, whatever it is, but it has to be that he had a part in cooking the food. Not just that the fire was turned on. A convection oven wouldn't be the best example for that. But let's talk about a stovetop. Not just that the fire was lit by the mashgiach in the morning at 8 o'clock in the morning when they started working in the restaurant, but that the frying pan was put on by the mashgiach. Now in Eretz Yisrael, which is different than in America, in America you tell a guy, the rabbi puts it on, or the rabbi turns on the fire. That's what's going to happen, more or less. You have to be mashgiach over it. You have to make sure that you have to have the mashgiach around to verify that they're not doing it. You can't just be saying machan a guy. But that's what's going to happen. If you throw, you tell an Arab not to do something, you can bet your bottom dollar that the guy's going to do it every time he has an opportunity. So the point is, in such a place, it's usually much smarter. They'd say the guy shouldn't be involved with the pasacham. They can cut vegetables, they can be the katsav, the butcher, they can cut the meat in all sorts of nice shapes and sizes and everything else, but they don't deal with the ovens, they don't deal with the stovetops, they don't deal with the fires, they don't deal with anything, and then they start asking you, what about warming up the food, what about if it's cooked, if it's not, and they start asking you all sorts of things. Anything that's going to get somewhat complicated, and it's not black and white, that it's not cooking it's usually going to be a smart idea, and if a kashrus organization really cares, they usually will say, the pasachan, the cooking areas are off limits to non-Jews. Now the next question is, what about someone who's not shomer Torah mitzvahs? Now, by ma'achole akum, there are two reasons, generally speaking, that Chazal were goyzer, the Chazal decreed that we cannot have, they made an enactment that we don't eat a food that was made or that was done in some way by a guy. There's the idea of chasmus, of not marrying, that we shouldn't come to intermarry with goyim. So you want to keep a certain distance between Jews and goyim. So that's one reason why sometimes Chazal were goyzer on Afiyas Yisrael, that it has to be a Jew that bakes the food, because baking is something that might bring some sort of kirva, and you know, so that might cause some sort of intermarriage type of problem. So Chazal were goyzer on certain things because of that. Mitzad Sheni, there are things that they were goyzer that they decreed upon, they made a rabbinic enactment that such foods are usur because of Shema Yachnis, because maybe they're going to put a davar usur, something which is forbidden to eat, like Chol Yisrael. The whole idea of Chol Yisrael is maybe they're going to switch it with Chol Tomei. And instead of giving you cow's milk, they'll give you milk from Behemoth Tomeo, which nowadays, it is relevant still nowadays. I got an email not so long ago about that wasn't like to me so much, but in certain countries, they have to watch out for camel milk. In a lot of the Arabian countries, they drink camel milk. And there is such a chash out there still today, that of Chol Tomei. But the idea is that Chazal made an act because of Shem Yachnis. So when it comes to Bishul Akum, to having a non-Jew cooking, the machlokes amongst the Paiskim, what the reason is for Bishul Akum. Now, the most generally accepted opinion, the vastly accepted opinion, I should say, is really more that it's because of Chasmus than because of Shem Yachnis. Which isn't necessarily the Pashtus and the Sugyo, you might argue is Mashma differently. But, nonetheless, that's a generally accepted opinion. If that's the case, it could be any Jew, because there's no problem with intermarriage by a non-religious Jew. They're a Jew, it's mutter, theoretically, to marry them. The rabbi might advise you otherwise. But, because of that, that's not going to be a problem if it's only because of intermarriage. It won't be a problem to have an irreligious Jew cooking the food, or lighting the fire. However, if we're talking about Shema Yachnis, so an irreligious Jew doesn't have nemonis, he doesn't keep Torah mitzvahs, everybody knows he drives on Shabbos, everybody knows he eats treif, everybody knows they're not makbid on the whole other good part of the other 613 mitzvahs. Man, they have no nemonis, we can't trust them when it comes to kashrus, and therefore just because they're Jewish wouldn't allow for them to do the cooking. Now, in America, as far as I'm aware, there aren't really kashrus organizations that are makbid that it should be a frum person, except for that, generally speaking, the Lafi the Ramah, at least, the lighting of the fire will be done by the mashgiach as part of the jobs of a mashgiach in most places in order to ensure that it was indeed lit by a Jew. So the one person that you know for sure is a Jew, at least hopefully, in any place, is the mashgiach. So, therefore, that's a job that's given to the mashgiach in most places around the world. But, and that's still, a lot of kashrus organizations are much more in favor of being makbid, like the shittas that hold that it's al shem yachnis, that it's because maybe they're going to put in something that's forbidden to eat. And therefore, they are going to be makbid at least, lefi, the das haramah, that the fires should have been lit by a frum person. And again, if we're dealing with ovens that turn on when you close the door, so the oven should be closed by a frum person, and they're either going to use then what's called a mashgiach, or they'll use nifty Israeli term that they came up with, a neman kashrus, a frum worker in the restaurant that maybe doesn't have the achrayas responsibility of a mashgiach for whatever reason, but he's frum, he's daven three times a day, keeps Shabbos, puts on tefillin, has the yarmulke, or she's religious and she keeps mitzvot for neman kashrus even in Eretz Yisrael, where they don't have, where for the most part, there aren't so many mashgichot, but they do have nemanei kashrus that are women very, very frequently. There'll be a woman baker, a woman a woman cook, a woman chef, a woman waitress, somebody who might be in the restaurant in this room, that they might allow, that they usually will also allow to be the one to close the oven or to turn on the fire, because that's going to work. We'll see all the day, like, that as long as you have somebody who's religious, that's going to be the same. So now, we've taken care of a lot of the problems associated with the cooking. The big problems of Bishlakim. And you walk on to the storage room. And the storage room, you're going to have to check that the Chomri Gelim have an appropriate Mahadra and Ashkacha. Whatever, Ashkacha is the Kashrus organization that's responsible for giving the Kashrus from the facility is comfortable with. Now, every organization will have their own list of Ashkachos that they'll accept. They might only accept their own Ashkacha whenever applicable, and not others' Ashkachos. But other Kashrus agencies might accept a whole slew of other Kashrus organizations of Ashkachos no matter what. And there might be differences in policies. They might accept it when it comes to Meretz Yisrael, you know, or when it comes from this country or that country, but not when it comes from Syrian countries, or it might be on product-by-product basis. So if you're not familiar with that Kashrus organization, just because you walk into the storage room doesn't mean that you're necessarily going to understand it. You see a product and you say, but they told me they don't use that. Might have been an exception for whatever reason, but it might not. Good thing to pay attention to. And that's one thing. Now, but when you make an exception, it's an important thing to know also. Remember, you open up Pandora's box. If you tell a restaurant that they can use a product, we'll make up a shkacha, but that's Atzei Chayim. And you tell them that they can use Bedat Atzei Chayim on tomato sauce. Why? Because you know what goes on. They make it in the same plant that the Haredis makes, and the Rav Reuben makes, and that all the other Magen Ashkachos make, and it's on the same exact Tekken, it's the same exact modus operandus, how they work. You know exactly how they work. It's the same Mashkiach, the Dutramatamais is the same way, the Makbid and Shemitah the same way, all the ingredients that come in, the spices, the various other chemicals that might be used, it's all up to par with all the other par excellence Mahajan Ashkachos. So you allow them to use it, but now the sapak, the supplier, says, well, they allowed it on the tomato sauce, so today I'll put in, I don't have peas from Bedat Tzeh Haredes, so I'll give them from Bedat Tzeh Chaim. And now the Bedat Tzeh Chaim peas come in, but the Bedat Tzeh Chaim peas come from a totally different place. It comes from some place in Ramallah. And you know that there's no kashrus going on there, no serious kashrus for sure. And it's a problem. But now the Mashkiach might have forgotten exactly what products you told him yes is okay, what products aren't okay, and the Mefakeh, the guy on top of the Mashkiach, comes into the restaurant, he sees it going on, and like, blah, it's a big problem, you don't know what to do, maybe it was Shemitah, maybe you have to kasher, maybe it was coming from a Jewish farmer in Shemitah, you don't know what's going on, and you have a whole big thing. So it's usually something which, for the most part, a kasher organization, not because they're being political, so you say, but I know that the tomato sauce is the same thing, and it must be that it's only because of politics, because they're not accepting B'tah Sotzei Chayim tomato sauce. Not true. Very often, other things have to be taken into account when a kashrus organization allows certain products to be used or not, or doesn't allow them to be used. And a kashrus organization that's being run by people with common sense, they'll have all sorts of gedarim that they might set up in terms of what they accept and what they don't accept. But you move on to, you go through the storage room, it's going to be all sorts of things. Now, you walk into a restaurant, you're going to ask them, where's your flour system? And if I tell you that they don't use flour, they're almost for sure lying. Because it happened to me when I first came into the kashrus scene here in Eretz Yisrael. I walked into a milchik restaurant and I asked them, where's your flour system? So they told me, we don't use flour. I told them, you don't use flour? I said, can I have the menu for a second? I looked at the menu and there was all sorts of nice pastas with sauces. I said, what are you using your sauce? They said, oh yeah, we put a little bit of flour in the sauce. So I said, okay, where's the sifter for that little bit of flour that you put in the sauce? The point is, there's almost nothing, because most sauces at home you might use some sort of starch. The cheapest type of starch you can use is flour. And in restaurants, unless they're selling it as gluten-free or something like that, there's going to be flour in any thick sauce. So there's always flour to use. It might be true that their baked goods come in from outside, they get it from the bakery that is a Haredis, or they get it comes frozen in dough from a bakery that might have six Ashkachos on it. That might all be true. But there's almost for certain flour being used in almost every single restaurant anywhere in the world. So when you come in, you want to see the flour sister. And they show you the flour sister, and they say, yeah, well, it has a hole in this corner. But it's okay, because the rest of it doesn't have holes. It doesn't work, because that's where all the bugs are going to end up. They're going to end up in that little big hole in the corner. So So the point is, a sifter, and you ask him, well, what do you do with that sifter when you finish? It might be, let's say it was a good restaurant, they don't have any holes in the sifter. So you tell them, what do you do with the sifter when you finish? So they say, we put it back in the bag with the flour. Now, why are you sifting flour? Because there might be little bugs in it. Now, I know most of you are going to say, well, when I sift flour at home, I don't find bugs. But I'll tell you how, if you want to see the bugs, I'll tell you how to see the bugs. When you finish sifting, you really can do it even with the flour that you sifted, because almost no sifter is going to be 100% bulletproof. But definitely with the stuff that stayed on top of the sifter, you take it, take a piece of white computer paper, or anything that's bleach white, tip it, bang it down on that piece of bleach white paper, lift it up, and you'll see little yellow dots, slightly yellow, off-white dots, crawling up the piece of paper. You won't be able to make out the anatomy, but because it moves, it has a din of being of a telas, of a bug, and it's going to be a problem. Try it at home if you're not afraid to. But it's very likely, again, if it was a very fresh batch of flour that just came to the supermarket, it just came from the flour mill, it was just milled, you might not find it. But at some point, if you do it a bunch of times, at some point you will find it. It does happen, and it could happen to anybody. It can happen from flour from almost any supermarket, from almost any company, and it's very likely to happen. So they tell you that they put the sifter back next to the flour, so those little bugs can just conveniently, that they spent a long time sifting, especially if they're using a hand sifter, will go straight back on to the flour. And the secret, if you wash your sifter by hand, it's going to be very hard, because when you mix flour with water, you get dough. So it's going to be very hard to clean it. But if you have a dishwasher, you put it in the dishwasher, it comes out perfectly clean. If it's a decent dishwasher, you put it in the right position, etc., it will come out perfectly clean. And that's the best thing to do after you sift flour. Put it in the dishwasher at home also, not just in a restaurant, and I'll eat your show. If you don't have it, keep it separate from your flour, at least, for sure. And you should wash it also. Main Levain, you get one of those nice brushes, like a nail brush type of brush, and you wash it with a brush. The truth is, I mean, that's Shaila more, since it's home kashrus. I mean, all kashrus shayla, as the Rav said before, you should always ask your Rav. But it's, for the most part, you know, you definitely aren't going to make it sleishik if you washed it in the milchik dish. It itself might be milchik after you wash it in the milchik dishwasher. That I'm not getting into. But when the flour that went through it isn't going to be milchik, because it went through, because the sifter got through a milchik dishwasher, it might not be the most lechatchila set up. But that's a different question. So again, you can always use the nail brush to wash it. But the point is that should be something definitely in a restaurant that's usually one gender. It should be washed. If it's a place that's two genders, a catering hall or a hotel, presumably then they're going to need an industrial sifter with an industrial mesh or whatever it is, a machine. But then they should also have, I always tell them to have two of them. One milchik, one fleishik, clearly marked. One goes in the milchik dishwasher, one goes in the fleishik dishwasher, and Al Yisrael Shalom. But the point is that that's something that you have to look out for. Then you continue to go through the restaurant, and you come up to the bar. Now, I'm not even going to get into hard alcohol, because there's about four or five different lists out there about hard alcohol, what's acceptable, what's not acceptable, and the reasons and the not reasons. The truth is, in America, it's actually becoming the fad amongst many cashless organizations that they're very soon only going to allow hard alcohol that has ashkacha on it, or very basic hard alcohol like unflavored vodka or things like that. But anything that gets a little bit more complex, they're not going to get allowed, because over years, as has been discovered in most areas of kashrus, many people here will remember that, depending on how old they are, I don't remember these things because I'm too young for that, but I'm sure there are people here who are a few years older than me, and they will remember that there were points in time where there were far more foods that were eaten without necessarily having any ashkacha, maybe even, or without having the same kind of supervision as we nowadays have. I definitely remember when I was a kid, in terms of tilloim, there were many things that were eaten that nowadays won't be eaten, or only be eaten after a thorough check or a thorough washing, etc. That might not have been the case when I was a kid. And
does that mean that something changed fundamentally, or
sometimes yes,
lacked then
sometimes yes, and sometimes it's awareness.
Sometimes it's what?
Sometimes it's awareness. the longer time there are Rabbanim in the field of Kashrut, and they start going from this place to that place, they start to notice all the issues that there are with something else. And the more time there are Tamir Chum that are learning Shulchan Aruch, and they start coming upon, they chance upon various issues in Halacha that might not have been so well trodden upon beforehand, they might say, you know, well, how come we eat X, Y, and Z? Who says that it's okay? Who says there's no bugs and that type of thing? Maybe we have to check it. And people start checking, they start finding there might be a mitzvah, and some of it might be in terms of the farming techniques. There might be all sorts of reasons why things become better or worse in kashrus, some of which might just be awareness, though. So, in the field of alcohol, it's a large part is just awareness to the field. Many years ago, people were less aware of what went into the makings of fine whiskeys, of all sorts of liqueurs, etc. Flavors was much more of a mysterious field, but I see that's on the agenda for the last shiur by Rabbi Schatz. That's going to be something that he'll discuss. He's a very big bucky in flavors. I'm not. So that's something that he'll discuss. But there's all sorts of things that make the hard alcohol field much more complex. And nowadays, there are a lot of kashrus organizations that are trying to shy away from using any list, per se, for the hard alcohol, but they're only going to use things that either have supervision on it or that are very, very simple. So we won't even touch the hard alcohol bar. But the wine. Now, also typically, many of us might be used to restaurants in America where you order any wine, you don't have to worry about whether you can drink it with a guy or not, it's a different Shiloh, but the actual wine that's going to come, it's going to be served, the waiter can pour out to you. Doesn't make a difference if he's Jewish, not Jewish, religious, not religious, how not religious, how religious. Because they only serve mezuzah wine. Wines that were boiled, halachically, whatever that might be, will feed a different shittos. But that's what they're serving. Here in Eretz Yisrael, it's very seldom to find a restaurant that serves only mezuzah wine. And they're going to serve non-mezuzah wine. So if it's non-mezuzah wine, how are they doing it? Now, the truth is I have a fundamental problem with non-mezuzah wine, b'chlal. Because whichever way you slice it, and whatever setup you have, the second that someone who's not religious that's drinking it, and definitely the second you have a guy that's drinking that wine, you have now Sam Yenom, which is also an Isidurabonon again, but it's Treif Midurabonon, and you have Treif of food in a kosher restaurant. Now just because the guy himself poured it for himself, or because the Mashkiach poured it to him, it's not a problem until he drinks it, okay, that's very nice, so the restaurant didn't sell you Treif, but nonetheless, there's Treif of food in a kosher restaurant. Now, the problems that you might have with that is A, it's back going back in the cups that are going into the dishwasher with all the other food, it might be poured on other food, it might stay in the sink overnight, maybe even 24 hours, just by a weekend, maybe they poured it onto some of the other food on the plate that might have been steaming hot, there might be all sorts of things, and some of these things might sound very far out, but someone who has a tremendous amount of experience in kashrus for many years, when I first came into the kashrus scene here in Eretz Yisrael, I was telling him once a scenario that I had that was very far out, actually with wine, so I'll get to that also. If you sell just a bottle of wine, which is actually the OU's thing, that's what their policy is until now, that Hashem will be changed, but when they sell a whole bottle of wine in a restaurant, so even though it's mevushel, even though it's not mevushel, and you're selling the whole bottle, and it's the guy who opens it's responsibility, but very often you're there with your religious cousin, you're there with your guyish business partner at a meeting there, and he touches the bottle, and because you're used to the setup where things are mevushel, so it might create a situation where there is a lifnei iver. So that, I know it sounds like a very far out lifnei iver, but maybe it's a problem. Maybe we should be chayshish for it. Maybe we should do something about it. So he told me, you know, it sounds a little bit too far out. Maybe we shouldn't. So he told me, there's nothing called too far out in kashrut. Anything that you think might happen, any problem that could occur, is going to occur. It's just a question of a matter of time, how long it will take till that problem occurs. So a good kashrus organization, again, is going to take that into account, and they might constantly reconsider their standards and their policies about all sorts of things, and it might be aggravating to a restaurant that they came on, and they were allowed to sell it, they were allowed to do it, and after a few months, you come to them and you tell them that we changed our policy and you can't do it. But that's something that you have to put in the contract when you sign a contract with the restaurant, telling them that all these things are subject to policy change upon reviews of various rabbonim, wherever they might be, and whoever they may be, that have a role in these decisions.
Why is that scenario considered far out? I mean, this happened to me. I was in a Mahajan restaurant in Yerushalayim with some guys, people from my work from New York, and
isn't far out. That a guy does that. That it happens.
Crazy. They brought a bottle of wine to the table that was not kosher. So there are Jews there who don't know the halacha.
Okay, so they have a sign. I mean, at least what they should have. Every kashrus organization that cares a little bit, at least, and hopefully they care at least a little bit, because otherwise no reason why they should be a kashrus organization. They'll put a sign up, and we'll say on the menu as well, that we sell, that wines are sold by the bottle only, they are not mevoshel, and it's to the discretion of the purchaser what happens with them. Now, but so again, you're right, it's not so far out.
Weird.
I'm glad that I hear that. I feel all the better that I'm not just a wacky.
I mean,
Granted. No, that's what I told you. That it's trade of food isn't far out the quality.
That's going to happen
because any Mahajan restaurant, if it's a decent restaurant, is also going to have people that aren't necessarily from it all or that are Goyish that might come in for food also. And Goyim are more likely to order wine and juice. And changing a little bit, but the point is, it's definitely an issue, and it's an issue, and the kashrus organization that cares is going to try to, whatever the policy might have been until now, we'll review it, and we'll change things, and they'll try to do their best in that scenario. And really, the best scenario for any kashrus organization is only Mavusha wine across the board. All Yisrael Shalom is taken care of. But big adult, that's the wine problem. Now, if they are selling non-mevoshel wines, they might have a scenario where that might take care of that problem, that you have a frum bartender who pours out the wine. Now, if you have a frum bartender that pours out the wine, this is also something I came across, where they're having some of the fancy restaurants because they don't want to sell you just a bottle, they want to sell you a cup, and they want it to come the right way, where it's poured properly, and bechule. So they come and they pour out the bottle of wine. Now they have open bottles of wine in the restaurant, so it's true they didn't leave it on the table. What happens when it's not there? So they have to have either a system to reseal the bottle immediately afterwards so that they don't have to worry about the other waiters and the other restaurant workers and other guests in the restaurant perhaps tampering and touching those bottles. It's either that, or they have to have an area where they keep it locked up and right away, take it from Mezigo, Me'ilo. That the second they put it, after they pour it out, it has to go back into the wine cupboard, locked by the Neman Kashrus Mashkiach, from bartender, whatever you want to call him. But what happens? A guy calls you back and he wants a second cup of wine. You can't pour into the glass where there was before because there's a little bit of wine left. It's kind of bustling. There's a mashicha. The way it works with wine, sorry, I should explain the concept. There are certain things that there's bittul b'roid. You pour in a large substance or something. If there's a large substance or something, it's fine. There's certain things that we say, kamakama bustle. You pour in, as you pour in, usually by liquid substances. But you pour in a liquid substance into another liquid substance that's already there, even though it's only a small volume, but because as you're pouring it in, it's only a tiny bit that touches per, however you get to measure the time or whatever it is, however you want to call it. It becomes bustle to whatever was, to the liquid solution that was there at the time. It becomes part and parcel of it. So if it's something which is usr, that liquid solution that's in the cup already, like stam yenam, wine that was touched by a guy. And now you pour in more wine, so even though the wine in the bottle, and that might even make a problem on the whole bottle, but definitely on the wine in the cup, so you have to have a system that it's going to be a fresh cup, no matter what, no matter who, no matter what kind of wine, no matter what, they get a fresh cup, each cup of wine that they order. Period. Nekuda. And if that system will take care of maybe other people touching the bottle on the table, it's a much more complicated system, much more expensive system, but that might avail a restaurant to sell non-mevushal wines, they want to sell the top quality wines, and they only come non-mevushal or whatever the taina is, and it will maybe solve a good part of the problem, except for the shloah that you can't see the wine. That once it's open, and definitely once it's open, perhaps even when it's sealed, but you can't see the wine. That's why actually Kedem in America, the non-mevushal wines, they make it in a green bottle. I'm not sure why that helps. Someone told me, well, you know, if it's just, you know, some sort of Kabbalistic thing, maybe something that's just, you know, kind of colored helps or whatever it is. I don't know. I'm not sure why it helps. That's what they've done to try to help, is that the bottle's green, still transparent, but it's green transparent, somehow That's the hocus pocus to take care of the shlo's problem, and they shouldn't see the wine. Nonetheless, it's actually not the shlo people talk about before the shlo. The shlo's just who made it famous. Anyway, the point is that that's going to be another issue that needs to be taken care of in any restaurant. The next issue, sorry, we should have talked about it when we talked about the paschal, the heat strip, is presumably in a fleishig restaurant, they're cooking also fish. You can order most fleishig restaurants, no matter how good the steak is there, they have an option of fish. So they might tell you almost nobody, and it's actually a little bit worse when they tell you almost nobody ever orders fish, because then the system is all the more vague, it's all less familiar to the restaurant workers, and to the mashgichim, and it's all the more apt to have problems. But you have to have you have to have complete and utter differentiation, separation between fish and meat. So, now in theory at home, many people may cook fish and meat in the same pot. There might be certain people who are makbenatsu, they have a minergnatsu, whatever it is, might be makbenatsu to use their meat pots for fish. But many people will use a pot they cook their chicken soup in 1 week, the next week they might cook their gefilte fish in. Be clean, it'll be spick and span, no problems, nothing left over from the meat, but they'll use the same pot. In a restaurant, a kashrus organization shouldn't allow that. Because there's rush, there's lachatz, there's pressure, they're in between things, didn't get washed out well, something, bein levain, there's some grease stuck to it, there's a little spot, it went into the dishwasher with 10 things on top of it, whatever it is, it's not perfectly clean. The kashrus organization should not be able to take responsibility for that, and they should say, we want a separate type of pot for fish and meat. We want a separate type of spatula. It might be the same kind, and they'll tell them to put a big keychain around it so that there's a separation, or to drill holes around the rim, or to engrave it somehow, or to do some sort of thing to make it look different, or that it's a totally separate color pot. They use blue pots for the fish, and they use red pots for the meat. Whatever it may be. But and then the cutting boards are going to have to be separate cutting boards. So they'll have a red cutting board for the meat and a blue cutting board for the fish, or a cutting board with a little frame of drilled holes in the side. One hole's not going to do it because when you're in a rush and there's a lot of pressure, you don't notice the one hole, especially your new worker in the restaurant or the mashgiach when he comes in to take a glance. He's not going to be able to notice that necessarily. It's just one hole. It has to be something which is a very clear and marked differentiation between the two. It might be the type of pot. It might be that they use a shallower frying pan for the fish and a deeper frying pan for the schnitzel, whatever it might be, but there has to be complete and utter separation between fish and meat. Another thing is, now you have a deep fryer. And in the deep fryer, it's a fleishik restaurant, you have a big sign, everything is becheskes besari, everything is fleishik in this restaurant, it doesn't make a difference, it can be chips, or french fries, whatever you want to call it. They're also fleishik, they're completely fleishik, you have that, you're fleishik the same way as if you have chicken wings. Why? Because they cook your chicken wings in the same exact oil as they cook the chips. Now the problem is when you order your fish and chips, those chips can't be the chips that are made with the wings. Those chips have to be chips that are made somewhere else. Now, there might be 30 kashrus organizations that are going to let them clean out the chips after they do the wings, empty out all the oil, put in mesir shumanim, run it with water and mesir shumanim to boil it up, clean it out, and allow them to use it again. That's a much more complicated conversation, whether that's sufficient or not sufficient. If you ask me, it's not really sufficient, but that different people will maintain different things about. If you've gotten to the bottom of a deep fryer, you'll see why it's not really sufficient. There's always stuff left in the bottom, no matter what they do. And so, just because pogrom, that might help by zalva shel iser, it might not help by chamira sechanti yisur by fish. Whatever it is, it's a whole separate question. Some kashrus organizations are going to be samech on that, no matter how mahajan they are. Some won't be samech on that. Some will make them have two totally separate fryers. Or tell them, you can't sell. I just had it now with the restaurant that we're in the process of kashering. I told them, well, you have two solutions. Either you buy a separate deep fryer for your chips that you serve with your fish. I said, how, you tell me it's not so often that people come in and buy fish. And then not always when they order fish, they order chips to the side dish. So you can buy one of those small home deep fryers that people have on their counters. You know, so it's very common that people have them on their counters, these little things that cost a few hundred shekels. It's not that big of an investment. That's one option. The other option is, you order fish, you don't get, there's no fish and chips, fish and baked potatoes, fish and rice, no chips. But that's something that has to be taken care of, is the complete separation between the two, and that includes that the side dishes that are served with the fish, on the, definitely if they're served on the same plate, cannot be made in real in the kalim that aren't good enough for the fish itself. That's another thing that a person must be aware of. Also, the serving utensils, sometimes in caterers, you'll notice that they'll offer you some sort of boreka or moussaka or something like that that has fish that has meat inside of it, or fish as an entree, and the guy sitting there with the same, sometimes it happens with the best hashkafas, and you see the guy sitting there with the same pan serving the fish and serving the meat product, that's a big no-no. That's something that has to be completely and totally separated. Washing off a spatula in between, having some sort of thing with soap water on the side of it, is not going to be sufficient either. It's a decent margin of shkacha. They're going to have separate spatulas for the fish and meat as well.
I was at a restaurant actually called about they serve meat and fish on the table at the same time. And
the same person or to two different people?
Well, it was like about 20 people. So some people were eating just fish, some people were eating meat, and some people were eating both. Now, some were irreligious Jews, but you've got the responsibility.
Okay, I'll tell you, that's actually, I'll repeat the question. Fellow over here asked, what's your name?
Pillow.
Pillow asked, what, if you have a situation, it might even happen more frequently in catering halls, the same exact example that I just gave. You have some sort of meat puff or fish that are being served, or it could be in a restaurant where different people, where people can order, they might have an option to order, it could be a main course by a chasana. You can order either some sort of grilled salmon filet, or you can have the meat option. Right, and so very often, I think what his question is, very often you might have somebody who'll say, as they say in Hebrew, "Lomishana Aseda." It doesn't make a difference which one you give me first. I'll take both. So the point is, you have someone who'll say, "I'll take the fish and the meat," and now they have the fish and the meat in front of them. Is that a problem for the restaurant to worry about? Now, for the kashas to worry about? I'd have to think about it. I have to think about it a little bit more. I don't want to give a final answer without thinking about it. Off the cuff, what I'd say is like this. Generally speaking, issues that are boiling, that are crystal clear, that everybody knows that you don't eat together, right? In every frum house, people know that you don't eat, everybody has fish by night, everybody knows. After you have the fish, you do a kinuach and a dachi, you take a piece of chal, you drink from a schnapps guzzle, or you just drink a soda, water, whatever it might be, but you eat and drink between the fish and the meat. Because of that, generally, kashrut organizations will say about things that are obvious that they don't have to take responsibility for. Now, because in the simcha maybe things are kind of people get engrossed in the simcha and they kind of forget things very often. There's all sorts of things that might get forgotten in the simcha or in restaurants, and I have a whole list of things that Be'ez Hashem one day I'll get to dealing with, but they're not necessarily so much so kashrut things. There might be more other halachic things or chayim issues. But the point is that that's why I said I have to think about it. It could be that since in such a situation where people get involved in just fretting at the various food options in front of them, and they might get carried away, maybe a kashrut organization should take some sort of responsibility for that. So I have to think about it.
Along the same lines, is a kashrut organization's responsibility to worry that irreligious people will also not? I mean, a buffet, they're both there.
Okay, so a buffet, I can't tell you all kashrus organizations. I know some kashrus organizations will be marked, but that it won't be in the same area, and they'll have different. They'll set up different plates in it for it. Might not be which one of the things I'm going to get to just momentarily. I'm going to try to touch upon milk restaurants briefly, but one of the things that are relevant. But definitely by fish and meat, and a lot of kashrus organizations will be marked that should be in separate areas. But yeah, it's along the same lines in theory, and it's something that theoretically also has to be thought about exactly what's the best way to go through it.
Even if you're an anus veritas kashrut, and you take the fish for whatever reason, and the vegetable to par it, people are sticking their fleshik, they're eating the steaks or the liver or whatever, they're sticking their the spoon into the rice and the peas.
What, in the middle of the table?
In the middle of the table. It's one bowl.
Okay, so I'm not going to talk about whether it's a chareis or not, but I'll talk about the rice and the rice and the vegetables in the middle of the table. Yeah. So the rice and the vegetables in the middle of the table. I guess in America maybe it's a little bit less of a problem because people won't use the forks or spoons that they have by their plate and the stuff in the middle of the table. But it's all, frankly, it's not necessarily the people's fault. Very often the halls don't put the serving utensils in the middle. So, hygienically speaking, it might be better not to eat from it either. And chamir sekanti yosem yisura. But if that's what's going on, again, I don't know that the kashrut organization can necessarily do anything about it other than say, so again, I'd have to think about if it's something that maybe a kashrut organization should say, period, there's no fish at the same time as meat. I hear that, I'd have to think about it a little bit more to think if that's something that's just for a kashrut organization to do or not, but you're raising a valid point.
You'll tell me if I have a bunch of questions.
Okay.
Number one, interrupting you or not.
First of all, the road after never interrupts.
Okay. First of all, can you give an idea about, there's a mashgiach in the restaurant. So I'm not talking about specifically OU policy, but maybe you can give a general idea. When do you have a mashgiach tmidi? When do you have a tzamud? When do you have an emon kashrus? How do you determine these things? How often is a mashgiach in the restaurant? What does he do there the whole time? That's a lot of questions.
Okay, no. So that was actually going to be in the final synopsis if they set it up once you have all the issues taken care of.
Okay, so I'll move on.
Sure.
Well, okay. How do you determine when you have a mashgiach tmidi, samud, nemon, and what do they do all day? Yes.
Okay, the drav and mush house, or that's
yeah.
The.
Yeah. Well, how do you know where the meat's from? Not you again. Not the OU. Not you.
All right.
You walk in, how do you know he's not getting meat when the mashgiach's not around? How do you know he's not getting meat at 2 o'clock in the morning from Ramallah? How do you know?
How does
any kashrus organization know? What do they do in a restaurant to make sure that the only meat that he has there, and chicken, is the meat that the organization approves of? What's the system?
So I'll take those two and then the Rav is more willing to take it. So, I'll just to answer the Rav Shilas. No, it's not usually what someone else does. Sorry, to answer the Rav Shilas, I know it's not something that usually other people do. Usually that's at least not in audience. But the way you set up Ashkacha is some kashrut agencies might have a policy across the board, that's really how it should be. Once you live in restaurants and you see exactly how it works, whether it's milchik, whether it's fleishik, probably should really always have pretty much hashkachat tzmuda. Now, there could be two systems of setting up hashkachat tzmuda. Very often a restaurant will tell them that when you meet initially with a restaurant who wants to get a mahadrin hashkacha, you tell them, well, you need to have hashkacha the whole time. You need to have a mashkichi the whole time. And I tell you, yeah, but, you know, I understand that maybe one day I'll be very busy, like such and such a restaurant, which is extremely busy. But right now, you know, the reason why I'm looking for a mahadrin hashkacha is because business is kind of slow. It's kind of, it's a real financial yoke for me to take on having, you know, paying another salary the whole day. So I'll tell them, so then you might take that into account. You might say, okay, well, now, in the morning, you make your preparations. So you need a mashkiach there when you're making preparations because they're making salads. So you need someone there that we know we can trust for washing whatever vegetables need to be washed, for checking whatever vegetables need to be washed, for sifting the flour, for checking the rice. And for when you check the rice, you have to have a proper area for that. You have to have some sort of rice table with a light box of a sort or something like that to make it more efficient. Unless it's a very small kumbut, maybe you can do it with just some sort of bleach white surface and decent lighting. But if it's anything, in any restaurant that uses rice in decent amounts, then you have to have a proper light box so the mashgiach can check it adequately and not have too much pressure on him when he's checking it, to check whatever legumes have to be checked, to check sesame seeds, etc. Now, after So you say that's for the preparations. You need someone there. You need someone there in the morning also when the rest to open up the restaurant, because you can't have that they have the keys to the restaurant, or definitely not they have the keys to the refrigerators or freezers, definitely where meat or poultry is being kept, perhaps where fish is being kept, although the Eid HaChareidus has a Mesairon, so hence many kashrut organizations in Eretz Yisrael have a Mesairon that on fish there's no Basar Shein HaSalam in the Ayin, even though I'll be Pashlus in Shulchan Aruch. Pashlus is pretty much before Shulchan Aruch, there is an issue of Basar Shein HaSalam in the Ayin on fish, at least if it doesn't have the Simonim on it, if it doesn't have its fins and scales on it, if it's scaled, cut, etc., and then it would need to have, then maybe many kashrut organizations might feel that you need to have also the issue of Basar Shein HaSalam in the Ayin on it. So you say, well, to lock up the restaurant and to open up the restaurant, we need to know that there's no meat that's coming in that's not during the closed hours. Oh. Okay, I'm sorry. I'm really sorry. So you have to have a system to monitor that nothing is coming in during the down hours. During the open hours, there's many more people around. It's much harder. So the refrigerators and freezers are going to have to be locked. The call puffers.
And the owner doesn't have the key.
The owner cannot have the key. Only the mashgiach can have the key. How do you ensure that only the mashgiach can have the key? The owner doesn't call the locksmith. There's locksmiths, hopefully, that are approved by the kashrut organization. The kashrut organization has some sort of deal with. And the mashgiach calls the locksmith out. The locksmith puts in the lock for it. The restaurant can have a company come in and put in a hinge for a padlock. And the mashgiach can go out and buy padlocks. It has to be a padlock that's deemed solid enough by the kashrut organization to be sufficient. L'chaira doesn't have to be neo-deo-ma in terms of it doesn't have to be that you need 10 different codes and 5 different keys to open up that padlock. As long as there's a padlock on, because halachically speaking, there's a certain amount that halacha requires from us, and if there's already a lot of tircha that goes into it, like any field, almost anything can be counterfeited, but halacha doesn't necessarily require us to take into account the fact that almost anything can be counterfeited. It has to be done in a tzura of pi halacha, and it has to be halachically break resistant.
How do you know he's not getting vegetables from that? You don't
know. Okay, so the vegetables, again, now it depends. That was a small place and a big place, it's going to vary. A small place, I one time walked into a place that won in Mahajan Ashkocha. And they to make a long story short, they won in Mahajan Ashkocha. I walked in there and they had another Mahajan Ashkocha. They had another so called Mahajan Ashkocha when I came in. And I made up with the Mashkiach from the other Mahajan Ashkocha that I meet in there. I mean, he didn't come on time, so I had a little bit of extra time to, you know, search around on my own. And I asked him, how often does the Mashgiach come in? He told me, once a week. So I said, where do you get your baked goods? So they told me they're getting their baked goods from a factory store that actually had my own Ashkach on. I knew exactly what was going on in the factory store. The factory store is magnificent. So that's where their baked goods come in. So I told him, well, can I see your oven? So they have two ovens, one on top of the other, one's pyre, one's flashing. One's pyre, one's milchik. So I said, can I see your pan for a pyre and milchik? They said, we only have one type of pan here. So I said, okay, so everything's becheskas chalavi, there's no such thing as pyre. I really didn't like the two ovens close to each other, fine. So then I look around, and I see they make their, it's not just a bakery shop, they make their yogurt blends, and they make their sandwiches. So the sandwiches, I asked them, where do you get your bread from? So they told me the bread comes from a Ada bakery, comes from Angels or whatever it was, one of Shanet. So fine, very nice. So I said, but it always comes in there. Now bread doesn't concern me as much because most of the bread in this country is taka, mahajim and a mahajim, but it still is a concern. The point is, so, I mean, that's much more easily believable that it's all Ada and that the cheapest bread might be from Angels or whatever else it is. There's much less reason to be worried about it, but still you need proper hashgach on that no matter what. Because again, you're not telling somebody that it's probably okay so you can eat it, it's not a bediyavet, it's not a shasat chak, you're being mischayef to a certain standard, you have to be careful about it. But then I moved on to the next thing. That was my justification maybe for the kashrut organization that was giving the hashgach that thus far. So then I asked them, well, what about the fruits and vegetables? They pulled out a receipt, I came in on Wednesday, they pulled out a receipt from Sunday, from a fruit and vegetable store. This was in German colony. They pulled out a receipt from a fruit and vegetable store from Ramat Eshkol that had an Eid HaChareidus on it. So we buy our fruits and vegetables from Eid HaChareidus. So, you know, judging from the speed of business, it might have been true that they didn't buy anything from anywhere else. But, you know, on a good day, during tourist season, they might run out of a tomato. At the end of the day, instead of selling 10 sandwiches today, they sold 20 sandwiches. They still have another 45 minutes to closing. They ran out of tomatoes. You can't sell a sandwich without tomatoes. So they send the guy to the grocer next door who's selling tomatoes with kashrut regila on it. There's no mashkiach to remeister. There's nothing going on there. So you have to be worried about those tomatoes coming in. So in such a restaurant, you have to have at least what's called pachis, a neman kashrut, somebody from that's there that you can trust. There wasn't a neman kashrut working in this place. I was also concerned about the yogurt. Asked them where they get the yogurt. They pulled out nice vadat mahad, tenuva vadat mahadrin, plain yogurt thing. Told me everything else is just syrups that get added in. And they pulled out syrups that had mahadrin ashkafos. But the yogurt, I said, there's no difference in taste and there's no difference in, you know, color between the non-mahadrin and the mahadrin. And there are vast differences between non-mahadrin yogurts and mahadrin yogurts because of enzymes that are used and vitamins and different things that are added in. The sources for that might be completely traced for the non-mahadrin because of all sorts of various coolers. There might be valid coolers. I'm not challenging those coolers, but it's definitely not mahadrin. And it's a real difference. It's a real significant difference. There's no way you can mark it as mahadrin. And there's no way of verifying that. You need to have a kol pachis always in such a place, an neman kashrus. Any restaurant that doesn't have an neman kashrus the whole day, you're going to have such problems. So in any restaurant, pretty much, you need to have a kol pachis, an neman kashrus the whole day to make sure nothing's coming in bein levein. The actual deliveries that are coming in, you need the receipt. The mashkiach has to check the kamut in the refrigerator every day. At the end of the day, a good kashrus organization is going to obligate their mashkiachim to take account as to how many meats there were, how many pieces of open meat there were hanging, you know, whatever different types of sections there might be, how many cut pieces of meat there might have been, however they measure it. It might be in boxes, it might be in actual pieces, it might, you know, there might be different methods of doing that. And if they aren't locked for whatever reason, because it's not practical for various different reasons, it has to be completely sealed, those meats. Above and beyond them having a key to the refrigerators and freezers, because you need to have l'kol pachis at all times of day, a svara of yoytze the nichna, that a mashkiach could perhaps come in at any point during the day or night, whether it's during working hours or not working hours, at least one of the mashkiachim, one of the kasher staff members in the restaurant, must have complete and full access to the restaurant at all times. Very often nowadays, since we're living in a state of the art generation, the yeter betichut, not as what they're being seimachan for Basar Shin and Salam Rayin, at least hopefully, and not what they're being seimachan for Ashkrachas and Minas, at least hopefully, and not what they're being seimachan for Yoytz Minichas, at least hopefully, is that they'll have a video camera system, a Magal Skura, that they'll have, that very often even maybe the kashrus organization itself will have access, internet access to it from their office headquarters. But the call of office is somebody from the kashrus staff has access to it whenever they want. They can go in and they can see that video. That's the yetzer b'tichut. That's for a little bit more, to make a little bit more certain that there is indeed no problem. That indeed, that's for the sake to make sure that indeed there are no kashrus problems going on. As nothing that's coming in, that shouldn't be coming in, when it shouldn't be coming in, as it should be, to add to the mirsis, to the fear. You know, I don't know if fear is necessarily the exact word we want to use.
Every restaurant, who gets this closed circuit TV?
So, as I said, ideally, it should be the cashless organization. Almost all systems that you have now are recorded by some sort of central place.
In every restaurant.
Most restaurants, absolutely. Not everywhere, but in a restaurant where you don't have internet access to from any place, if there's internet access, so the cashier's office will usually ask for it so that the secretary or a cashier's worker, one of the bottom of the office, somebody can monitor. If they don't have that access, internet access is a little bit more of a primitive system, then they should definitely call office Machayim, and one of the mashkichim or somebody from the cashier's staff has complete access to that system at any moment in time, that he can go into the office and watch it, or he can go into wherever it's recorded and watch it somehow so that he can monitor when he's not there. Now, very often, even when you have a shelf at Tamidus, you have the floor of the restaurant where they're serving food. You might have one preparation area, you might have one kitchen that might be somewhat separate. The mashkiach, kind of, you can't be in three places always at the same time. So always tell the mashkiach, and that's what should be the setup, is that he should monitor those video cameras, and even if he doesn't find a problem, so that the restaurant should be aware, and the staff members in the restaurant should be aware that he's monitoring the problem. He should every so often go over and tell one of the workers something that he could have only known if he would have seen it on the camera. I'm going to ask you, how do you know that I did that? Not a kashrus problem. No, I'm saying, you know, you made a very pretty tzuv on whatever platter it was. You know, you made a very nice design on the platter. I said, but you weren't here then. I say, oh, yeah, but I watched the video camera, Ben Levine. There has to be something that they know every so often that the Mashiach does have the ability and the Mashiach does do it so as to create a mirror. So again, halachically speaking, sometimes the Yosef and Nichas might suffice, even though it might not be a full bulletproof guarantee, but a kashrus organization that's really concerned and is taking it seriously will generally apply some form of Hashgachas Midas where they have, unfortunately it's not all the time, and there's kashrus organizations that can completely ignore it and they only have Yosef and Nichas and they call themselves Mahajan. You know, if you speak to Yechiel Spiro, he'll tell you about all sorts of places that he might have walked into and found that to be the case. But there really has to be a system where there's always at least some sort of front person that is able to answer to the kashrus organization and sees what's going on in the restaurant.
To what extent is
it? I think the Rabban just wants another question.
One more question. Is there any system for being mashgiach on the mashgiach?
Okay. Any good kashrus organization, and there are some that have deteriorated over the years, that will have a whole hierarchy. Actually, there are some kashrus organizations. When I first took the job here, I was told we don't call it a hierarchy. I said something about the hierarchy. They told me there's no such thing. They told me we call it Shemir al Gabi Shemir. That the point is even the hierarchy, so to speak, gets monitored by the Mashkichim, gets monitored by the Mefaskim. Everybody gets monitored by each other because it's a multi-level, multi-faceted system. Everybody sees what everybody else is doing. And it gets around the system that's well woven. There should be definitely the basic system that's going to be, which we could definitely call a hierarchy, is you have a mashkiach. Top of the mashkiach, you have a mefakeach. You have somebody who comes around to check up on the mashkiachim. Now, another thing is, very often, and this is something that some kashrus agencies don't like, because they say it's putting down the mashkiach on some sort of level. I don't understand it, but I respect everybody's views for whatever it's worth. And that same way a worker comes in, many of you might have this in your office, depending on what kind of office you work in, that you swipe a card or you type a code into the computer system when you walk in. So that way they know that you walked in at this hour and you left at that hour. And if you leave in the middle of the day, you have to swipe the card. And I told her, and the basic system for monitoring for Mashkiach, the Zati should be the same type of system. Mashkiach swipes the card when he walks in. So some people told me it's humiliating for the Mashkiach. Mashkiach has to be above that. A mashkiach is human. A mashkiach doesn't have to be above that. He has to have a lot of respect from everybody in the restaurant, even the managers of the restaurant. That I always tell them they can't argue with a mashkiach. If they have a problem, they're welcome to call him a fakeach. They're welcome to call the office. They're welcome to call Rav Masha. They're welcome to call whoever it may be to complain about it. A mashkiach doesn't always have to be right. He doesn't. He might not have been nice. He might be mean. It might be something that the kashrus organization has to deal with and something that you should bring to attention. But when the mashkiach is here, it's as if the Rav Masha himself is here, and the same respect you have for the Rav Masha, you have for the mashkiach. You call and complain afterwards, and then it's the Rav Masha's job or the mefakeach's job to look into it or to bring it to the attention of whoever needs to bring it to their attention. So there has to be a certain amount of respect. Nonetheless, a mashkiach, there has to be a way of monitoring the mashkiach coming. Also, a mefakeach should come by, and generally, I think it should be, against my opinion, just from being in restaurants, that a mefakeach should come by and call pochis once a week. And depending on the exact type of system, but there should be somebody above the mefakeach who's coming in back once a month and who's monitoring how often the mefakeach comes in. The mefakeach should also have to give a report whenever he came in to whoever is above him or to the office, saying just a slight ticket, a checklist that he checked that everything is in order and that he was in the restaurant. And you know, a place to add comments, if there's some sort of comment that needs to be added, something that needs to be fixed. But there should be some sort of system in place in order to monitor that the mashkiach doing his job, in order to monitor the fakeach doing his job, and you know, even a Rav Masha, the satellite kashrus organization or whatever it is, there should be some sort of system, which is very often why organizational kashrus organizations have more stability than private kashrus organizations. One of the reasons is because the system usually, there's not a perfect hierarchy, there's a lot of people on similar levels. The other reason is there's various facets, there's various components to the organization. There's the Baal Batim, there's the Rabbanim, there's the workers, there's the Paiskim, there's different components to the whole organization who oversee each other and might have problems with each other, might have issues with each other that they'll bring up, and each one might have some sort of power over the other, the same way our government system in America works, or a government system in any democracy to some level works. That's going to be something which is crucial and important as well in monitoring Akasha's organization. The other thing, which is a milestone in a organizational Akasha's organization as opposed to a private Akasha's organization, is a private Akasha's organization, the guy who's at the top has an interest in each and every food establishment at a very individual level, whether it's a company, a factory, a plant, a restaurant, a caterer. Every place is extra money that goes into the bank account, which is really his personal bank account. So it's like any personal business. He doesn't want to lose any customers, and he's going to try to keep whatever customers he can.
I'd like to, wrap up, we'll have to have questions, but I would like to, there's no way the Rav will stay here for days. This was, I think at the very least, and that's what the hope is of this whole Tachnit of the show, would be the different aspects of Tasha's restaurants, hotels, and everything that else that goes around in between it, that we as a people have to get an understanding of what's involved, and it is complex, and it's not just a scam, it's not just money, it's not just politics. But it's people ensuring that we can go out to eat the way we'd like to and the way we should. And I hope it will give the people, one, an appreciation, and two, an understanding of the chashivut, of the importance of the mashgiach in the whole barechet, and like I've always tried to say, to ask for the mashgiach, and to speak and to learn what to ask and how to ask and what to look for. I'll ask the Rav if he can stay a bit long and open up for a few questions, and as the Rav's time permits, and go from there.
To what extent do you rely on the Nemlin Kashrut, a paid salary worker for the restaurant, and has an interest in keeping his job in the restaurant, and may not be so willing to find problems that can cause him problems?
Okay. Any Nemlin in any good Kashrut organization, again, can't tell you every Kashrut organization, but in any good Kashrut organization, what they should do is that the same way a mashgiach, actually I'll tell you a secret. Most kashrut organizations, there are very few kashrut organizations that pay the mashgiach straight because of legal issues. There's workers' liability. If chalila, an accident happens in a kitchen or in a factory, and there's an accident that happens to the mashgiach, if he's not an employee of the establishment, there's going to be problems in terms of why he was there. There can be all sorts of lawsuits. It's not as simple as the insurance is going to cover it. So for legal reasons, very often it's going to have to be that the mashgiach even is going to be an employee of the restaurant. So how do you work around it? Because you're right, it's a problem. If he's more mishubah to the restaurant than he is to the kashrut organization, you're in problem. So the way that we work around it is, and it's done legally with lawyers in any place that really cares, it should be fully bulletproof, is that there's a contract written through the OU, through the kashrut organization to this mashgiach or neman kashrut for the restaurant. That yes, he's an employee of the restaurant, but his employment for the restaurant is upon the conditions set by the kashrut organization. And if he has a raise in salary, that's up to the OU. That's up to the kashrut organization. If he needs to get fired, only the kashrut organization can fire him. If he has anything else that happens with relative to his job, what he does in the restaurant is up to the kashrut organization. You know, if it's an Emin kashrut that we're talking about. So if until now he was working on the grill, and then he's going to be moved to the inside of the kitchen to work on some sort of other type of cooking, on frying or whatever it is, that's only the kashrut organization's decision. And the restaurant can ask for it from the kashrut organization, and the kashrut organization might say, we don't really care if he's working on the grill or frying, with a deep fryer in the kitchen, so yes, you can move him there. But it has to be done through the kashrut organization. And therefore, his shibo to the restaurant, his relationship to the restaurant, comes and is controlled by the kashrut organization. It's really very often, it would be much nicer if he would be able to be hired and paid fully through the kashrut organization. But because of various legal constraints, for the most part, there are certain situations where mashgiach is paid completely and entirely by the kashrut organization. But for the most part, even with the best kashrut organizations anywhere in the world, that's basically set up because of all these legal issues that come up. So that's true for a mashgiach, true for an neman kashrut. Usually the difference between a neman kashrut and a mashgiach is you have a guy who's broke, but didn't necessarily learn yeshiva, didn't necessarily, you know, not necessarily Talmud Chacham, you know, and you don't necessarily know, because at home maybe he's not the most makbid on maybe bugs or whatever it is, you know, maybe he doesn't wash it exactly the way you would want him, the kashrus organization would want him to wash it. So you don't want him to wash the vegetables, or you don't want him to be responsible for whatever other mashkiach work there might be, but you don't have a problem with him, there's no problem with him cooking, there's no problem, you trust him if he says that there's nothing that came in, that in terms of orders or whatever it is, there's nothing that came in during those hours, he's trustworthy for that, he has an emunus, and that's not a problem. But to put on him the whole yoke of being having a full responsibility, that, you know, that you can't do, or because he's busy cooking, so he can't be also on top of the vegetables, or also on top of the orders in the morning, or whatever it might be. He needs to be, he's working in the kitchen, he's a worker really, and he has a certain amount of money with regard to kashrus, but he can't be responsible for all that. But the setup in terms of his hierarchy, who he has to answer to, is going to be the same as a mashkiach.
I'm sure you have to occasionally revoke licenses. What state or how bad situation would you consider having to revoke?
Okay.
The question was, if a restaurant's kashrus has to be revoked, how bad
the thing got to get before such a decision is made. Okay, a good kashrus organization, like we said, there's no such thing as bidyabed. There shouldn't be. So, if there's a problem, a real problem, now there might be something on policy that isn't what they tell all the whole world about in terms of the standards that they guarantee you, that they might have violated. It was an accident. So, you know, they'll give them a warning and they'll go on further. Because it didn't make a kashrus difference, it was a policy issue, you know, and now you throw a shalom. If it was an issue of something that actually is the equivalent of a standard problem, or definitely if it was a real bona fide halachic issue, that it was usher, so then whatever was done until now was done anyway. And whoever ate there because it had the chotem and it had the stamp of whatever kashrus organization ate there. Now, you have to deal with it from henceforth. If it's a problem, it can be fixed up immediately. And it was done by accident. It wasn't done on purpose. When something's done on purpose, it has to be viewed with much more severity. If something was done as a complete accident, then it will take the best scenario. It was done as a total complete accident. Something came in that shouldn't have come in, and it seemed, it appeared, whatever it was, that it was okay, or the mashgiach was doing something else at the time, and he wasn't really responsible, and it was a yoytzim in a cloud, because whatever this exact situation was, but it was pretty much really a complete accident, an unforeseen complete accident. So then you're going to say, if we can fix it up immediately, so we'll fix it up right now, it's all fine from here on, and whatever it was, so before then, if they want to put out some sort of recall for those products that were sold, the kashrus organization will usually have to put out a recall on those products. But from henceforth, it will all be mistaken. If it's a real problem, let's say something happens, typhus comes into the restaurant, and the restaurant needs to be kashrus. So they'll tell the restaurant, you have to close shop for a day, 2 days, whatever it is, it was typhus here. You have to close shop, or you can only work the cold things, you can only work in this area where the typhus definitely never didn't come into, didn't touch, only in these types of cases. And you'll have to work out those types of scenarios if it's possible to do such a thing. Usually, but you have to kasher. Kashering always takes more than 24 hours, because you need to wait after it was clean 24 hours until you can do the kasher. So it takes a few hours to clean whatever you're kashering. It takes 24 hours, you have to wait in between. Then it takes a few hours to do the kashering, at least, depending on how big the place is and what kind of utensils we're talking about, if it's kasherable with the cloth. So you'll have to stop things from going on for a while. The other issue is, now if it happened at a weekend, it's much more convenient, because you have a built-in 24 hours of Shabbos, and they clean Thursday night or whatever it is, or Friday morning, they have 24 hours of Shabbos, so the Shabbos is coming, you do the Achshara, and now you throw a shalom. But the issue, if it's something that was done either on purpose, or something that cannot be fixed, that's the point in time where you're going to have to say, no more hashgacha. Now sometimes you might take into account...
Immediately.
Sometimes, let's say for whatever reason, it was in between. It was gray. It wasn't that they did something bizarre. They didn't do it mamish, purposely, and against you. But it wasn't really an accident. It should have been foreseen. Now it might have been the mashgiach's fault. If it's the mashgiach's fault, the mashgiach is going to be the one who has to be fired. Or have to suffer some sort of severe repercussions for it. But if it wasn't the mashgiach's fault for whatever reason, it was the restaurant's fault, so you might slap the restaurant with more hashgacha. You might tell, well, you've only had one mashgiach, so now you need to have two mashgiachim. Or we let you have a nem on kashrus, now you need the mashgiach there the whole time. You might start doing various things like that. There might be a knas. You might tell them that we have to, you know, we're charging you more money for your kashrus for the next year. And that's usually not just because the kashrus organization is going to make more money now. They're going to send the mifakeach in more frequently. That once a week, they send the mifakeach in, they're going to send them in twice a week now. And that's more hours in the mifakeach's time. And so they're going to need to charge more money for that.
Last two more questions, then we'll close officially, and then it's up to Rob how much he wants to say.
Yeah. Is it possible to put together a list of questions that you could send to us by email that we could ask when we are faced with situations of a heksher that's not a Mahadran one, but we have a family obligation to be there? Is there such a thing?
I'll tell you, two points. Theoretically, I'm more than happy to do that. Practically, it will take me a little bit of time. Now, aside from that, you have to remember, in Eretz Yisrael, there's a machlo, there's a magefo, which is, we kind of think that we can go into any place. There's a mashgiach, he's probably somewhat from or whatever it is, and we can start asking him questions as to what we can eat and what we can't eat, and usually there's going to be things that we can eat. It's not necessarily true. Again, there's only one kitchen. The food's prepared in the same kitchen, and the food's prepared in the same kitchen. It's very hard to say this you can eat and that you can't eat, and this you can eat and that you can't eat, and whatever else it is. Either it's the type of place that it's sufficiently good that you can eat there, maybe even if it's not 100% lechatzila, something that I told you before. You have a frum mashgiach who's taka erlich, and he tells you you can eat there, he has a certain amount of nemanus. Whether you should do that or shouldn't do that is a different. Is a whole different parasha, whether that's sufficient or not sufficient, is a whole different parasha. But that might be, it might be then that you can eat and that you can eat everything. But it's very difficult. The second someone starts to tell you, well, this meat comes from there, so it's okay. But what do you mean? It's all cooked in the same pot. And they use Tatar Mechira during Shemitah, and you don't want to use Tatar Mechira, especially if you're doing like a Chazanish or whatever it is. And, it's, and then you have to, and it was on Tzvichin, so Tzvichin are a Chavs of the Surah, and then the Pshat, so then you have to Kasher or whatever. It's not just Kedusha Shvius, but it's actually Usher. So then you have the kasha afterwards. It wasn't kasha afterwards. It's the same candle that are being used over and over again. Whatever the scenario is, there's barm charifim that go into candle, and it becomes very complicated. It's very hard to say that one meal was cooked in this kitchen is okay, and the other thing wasn't okay. It's not like when you go over to someone's house, it doesn't keep your standards, and they told you they cooked everything in chad pami. In restaurants, in hotels, they're not cooking in chad pami for you. So it's very, very difficult to really do that properly, to think that you're really going to get away with it.
One last question, please.
Who was first? I'm sorry.
How does the person know, determine what the good conscious, you know, what conscious organization does? How do I?
That's why you have a love.
How do I know what Ruben's doing?
So I'll ask you like this. You're right. What was that?
What did I say?
That's a bunch of articles, a series of articles. The Rav wrote a series of articles on those types of issues. It's actually a little bit complex, but there are questions that you can ask him. If you were accepted what I said a good kashrus organization should do, if it sounded right to you, and you're willing to accept that, so you can ask your kashrus organization, are you makpid in all the things in the restaurant? You want it in writing? So like I told him, sorry, actually I know you from somewhere, but
Ashurazi.
So I'm sure if you ask, so just like Ashurazi asked, you know, something that theoretically I could put a list into also the questions that you can ask the kashrus organization to see if they're doing these types of things and indeed enable you to do it. And again, like I said before, it doesn't always mean, it's very often a halachic side. Halachically, you're not required to have a shkachas to meat that's necessary to monitor the meat. But if you really want to monitor that the meat, what it is, you need a shkachas to meat. Halachically speaking, again, you might suffice with the nichnas that comes in and he saw it before and he knows how many pieces are there, the siman and whatever it is. I'll tell you actually just a very brief story. Moshe Feinstein was interviewed once by the New York Times. I think it was in the '80s, and I think like 1982. And they asked him, what made him the premier kashrus authority in the world? So he said, so what do you mean? And he said, it's very simple. That what happened was, over years, I started off, I was a young girl, people asked me shilas. The answers that I gave made sense. People liked the answers. You know, then Sir Rabbanim started to hear about some of the psakim. Sir Rabbanim started asking me questions. And over time, more and more people heard about how much sense my psakim made. And they continued to ask me shilas until one day I became pretty much the most popular psakim, if you want to say it like that. Now, so the thing is with the kashrus organization and halacha, so things have to make sense. When someone fudges and doesn't answer your questions, if you call up and you ask me questions and they explain to you how to mashgiach on the plate, if it makes sense, if it sounds right, so it's much more likely beseder gamur. If it doesn't sound right and they start fudging, they don't know how to answer your questions, and then that's the whole purpose of this course by the Gazil Spiro and the Rav set up, and that's my relative that was involved in setting it up. The whole purpose of these types of things are to make people more aware of the issues involved in food services and restaurants, or the various topics that will be discussed henceforth by the various speakers. And so there's a whole slew of questions. I'm happy to put together in theory a list. I can send to Phil Spiro, who can put it even on his website or forward it to whatever type of mailing list he has. I'm more than happy to do that. Theoretically, again, I say practically, I don't know exactly when I'll have the time to do it. Don't want to be mishaving myself to a time frame.
Next week, we have the chairman, Rabbi Tzvi, who will speak about Simanim and Chotamot, which will deal with many of the concepts of our
Thank you.